The headlines: Iran denounces European Parliament's resolution against the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, saying the force is the world's biggest anti-terror organization. The French government defends its controversial pension reform despite strikes and protests against the plan. And also in our headlines, the U.S. and Finland announce new military aid for Kiev ahead of a NATO meeting that discusses whether to send modern battle tanks to Ukraine. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has denounced the European Parliament for its resolution against the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Nasser Kanani says the IRGC is the biggest anti-terror organization in the world. Kanani says Israel is the largest organized terrorist entity in the world, with the UK being its founder and the US its biggest supporter. The Iranian spokesman described all those three as the global club of terrorists. He said blacklisting the IRGC is because of their anger at the Iranian force. On Thursday, the European Parliament passed a resolution calling for designating the IRGC as a terror group. The Iranian army has also strongly condemned the move. It said the measure is a sign of desperation after enemies failed in their plans to support the recent riots in Iran. Meanwhile, the Iranian parliament has introduced a motion that will blacklist armed forces of EU countries as terrorist entities if the EU implements its resolution. We were earlier joined by journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas. He explains why the West continues to take more anti-Iran measures.
It's because I haven't seen the British establishment started to throw the toys out of the pram quite as robustly as they're doing at the moment. They seem to be very, very irritated at the failure, the latest failure of their regime change efforts. They seem to be taking it out on a lot of the Islamic centers or the centers linked to the Iran over here as well. So we're feeling the pressure even here. They have their pro-riot groups across the world who are all mobilized and remain mobilized, and they're supporting them in every way, shape, and form as well. But what they're really upset about is that the IRGC consistently has successfully countered terrorism in the West Asian region. And as Mr. Ghani says, it's absolutely the case that all of that terrorism, and all, I mean all of that terrorism in West Asia, all of it can be taken back to either Whitehall or to the gates of Tel Aviv, or the gateways of Washington. This is just a plain and open fact. There is no doubting anybody who's worth anything in politics knows this to be the case.
The first International Congress on Influential Women has kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran, bringing participants from more than 90 countries. Women from different sectors are in attendance. They include actresses, academics, lawmakers, environment and civil rights activists, as well as healthcare workers, among others. At the end of the gathering, three women regarded influential in the world will be awarded. On Thursday, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi met with some of the top attendees. He said such events can pave the way for international cooperation in the future. The Iranian president praised the great role women have played throughout history. He also expressed hope that participants attending the Congress can benefit from Iran's experiences in upholding women's rights.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The two-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace-building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in three fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, for example, Algeria, the woman Algeria and the woman Iraq, and it take the relation very important because the Islam is number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Elsewhere, Japan is feeling the pinch of skyrocketing energy costs as official data shows consumer prices rose at a level not seen since December 1981. Japan's consumer prices rose 4% in December from a year earlier. The figure was also up by 0.3% compared with November. The increase in prices of telecommunications fees as well as a range of processed foods also contributed to the December acceleration. The figure is below record inflation rates in the U.S. and Europe, yet it exceeds the inflation goal of 2% set by the Bank of Japan. The bank, however, has so far resisted calls to increase interest rates. To tackle inflation, it says the price increases are temporary and linked to events like the Ukraine war and soaring energy prices. France's finance minister has defended the government's pension reform plan that will increase the retirement age from 62 to 64.
We also strongly believe that this reform is a necessity for France. It's the best way of protecting our pension system. It's the best way of ensuring more prosperity for the French people. The French economy
is doing well. The minister also said the strikes over the pension reform are unlikely to hurt the French economy. That's because, he said, France has a very low inflation rate and is doing pretty well. On Thursday, the French people hit the streets across the country to protest the reforms that will also make it difficult to receive full pensions. Trade unions put the number of protesters at over 2 million. The rallies in the capital, Paris, turned violent with clashes between protesters and police. In the meantime, workers in different sectors went on strikes nationwide, halting trains and blocking refineries. New protests are planned for January the 31st. We asked geopolitical analyst Jeff Brown about the French finance minister's latest remarks and why he has decided to downplay people's economic woes.
We're watching inflation going through the roof. He is totally out of touch with the common people, the 99%. It is true the pension system does need to be reformed. The administrative costs are about 25% versus 2 to 3% in the United States, and they are very low. The pension the pension payment for non-governmental people is very, very low, especially for entrepreneurs and independent workers. So, but it's his perspective is from the 1%, but for all of us down here, you know, living day to day, the pensions need to be reformed up. And that's why people are at least trying to hang on to the 60 years. But, you know, this is typical Western, cacocrat, you know, the government by the worst. They don't care about the people. If they really cared about the common people, they would go surround the Bank of France. They would go surround the legislature, and they'd go surround the president's office and stay there. Those are the real enemies.
The United States and Finland have announced new military aid for Ukraine despite Russian warnings against providing Kiev with more arms. Washington and Helsinki announced their assistance ahead of a NATO meeting. That meeting discusses whether to send modern battle tanks to Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has thanked the West for its support but said his country needs more weapons in its fight against Russia. Zelensky has also called on his Western allies to provide the weapons more quickly. Ukraine argues that Russia is regrouping, recruiting, and trying to re-equip. Moscow has time and again warned the West against its arms deliveries to Kiev. Russia says the measure prolongs the war. It also says that Western tanks for Ukraine will change nothing. Russia's foreign minister has reiterated Moscow's readiness to discuss the war in Ukraine with Western countries. Sergei Lavrov, however, says Russia has yet to see any serious proposals for peace. He says peace talks need to address Russia's security concerns. Lavrov made those remarks in a press conference in Moscow. He said Washington has subjugated Europe to its dictatorship in order to wage war against Moscow.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov has held a press briefing to give an update on the ongoing war in Ukraine. In his press briefing, which was held in Moscow on Wednesday, Lavrov accused Ukraine's foreign policy of being under the dictation of Western nations. The Russian top diplomat further noted that Western nations have yet to make, quote, serious proposals to Russia on how the conflict should be resolved. Lavrov added that Russia was willing to support a draft truce proposed by Ukraine in late March, but the proposal was destroyed by Ukraine's Western supporters. He also said, in reality, the West decides for Ukraine what its foreign policy should be. Western officials have repeatedly claimed that arming Ukraine would help it achieve a better negotiation position and that no talks with Russia should take place before this happens. Lavrov further said Moscow would react to any serious proposal for overcoming the crisis that come from the US and its allies, but none has been sent so far. He also added that the West is using Ukraine to destroy the security system that existed in Euro-Atlantic for many years.
Western nations led by the United States have pledged to give more advanced weapons to Ukraine in the coming weeks and months. Ukraine's president has urged Germany to supply his country with more heavy weapons, criticizing Berlin for its hesitation to hand over its modern Leopard tanks to Kiev. Berlin says it will supply Kiev with tanks only if the U.S. sends its Abrams tanks first. Washington, however, refuses to make such a delivery.
Lavrov's comments come amid deepening crisis in Ukraine. On Wednesday, a helicopter crash killed Ukraine's interior minister, his deputy, and the state secretary of the ministry. The deaths have been described as a huge blow for Ukraine. The United States and its Western allies are also ramping up their support for Ukraine. Reports say Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, met for a couple of hours with Ukraine's chief military officer, General Valery Zaluzhny, in Poland. This is the first face-to-face talks between them since the war began in February 2022. The meetings are expected to focus on Ukraine's ongoing and future military needs. The United Kingdom has also pledged a squadron of its Challenger tanks, but it has too few to form the basis of a Ukrainian force. The moves by the United States and the UK come amid an apparent rift in the anti-Russia coalition.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. That is, some of that is non-military aid. Some of that is, you know, the likes of humanitarian support, such as generators. Some of that is obviously military hardware. Some of it is training. We train 10,000 Ukrainians in the UK, and we'll train another 20,000 in the UK, and some of it is effectively backfilling British stock.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has named Boris Pistorius as the country's new defence minister at a time of mounting pressure on Berlin from Western allies to allow Ukraine to use German-made tanks in the war with Russia. However, Germany says when it comes to sending tanks to Ukraine, Berlin is still waiting for the US to take the lead.
And this is the strategy we have, that we are strategically interlocked together with our friends and partners, that we are working together with them, that we are discussing with them, and that we are never doing something just by ourselves, but together with others, especially the United States, which are very important in this common task to defend the Ukrainian independence and sovereignty.
Germany is under pressure to participate in a broader alliance of countries that will supply Ukraine's army with modern Leopard 2 battle tanks. The previous German defense minister, Christine Lambrecht, was a loyal defender of Chancellor Scholz's cautious tank stance. Analysts said the delay so far has to do with disagreements amongst Western countries about the lethality of the weapons Ukraine needed. Russia has denounced the Western weapons supplies. Officials say Ukraine's allies were using the country as a tool to achieve their anti-Russian goals. Kremlin says the tanks that the UK pledged will burn just like the rest.
That's a wrap for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Experts have recently warned that the probability of U.S. economic downturn in 2023 is very high, despite the signs of easing inflation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT had an eye on this issue, saying higher interest rates will push the U.S. economy into recession in the coming year. The Wall Street Journal reported recently, citing its latest quarterly survey of economists. According to the report by Wall Street Journal, business and academic economists on average put the probability of a recession in the next 12 months at 61%. The forecast is slightly changed from 63% in October's survey. The WSJ report indicated that the Federal Reserve had initially hoped it could bring down inflation with only a slowing in economic growth rather than an outright contraction, an outcome dubbed a soft landing. However, three-quarters of respondents polled by the Wall Street Journal said the Fed wouldn't achieve a soft landing this year. The warning comes despite a slightly more optimistic outlook on inflation. The report said that, as measured by the year-over-year change in the Consumer Price Index, inflation has eased from 9.1% last June to 6.5% in December. Economists expect it to fall to 3.1% by the end of this year and see it ending 2024 at 2.4%. While recent inflation prints have shown some progress, a few persistent categories like core services are associated with the historically tight labor market, suggesting that there is still a long way to go for the Fed, Deutsche Bank economists told the WSJ in the survey. They explained the Fed would stay on its tightening trajectory to restore the rebalance of labor market and price stability, which, in our view, would engineer a sharp rise in unemployment and recession. Meanwhile, chief economist at EY Partinen, Greg Thaco, said that while services activity remains robust, the housing sector is tumbling under the weight of elevated mortgage rates and manufacturing activity is stalling, both signaling a broader economic downturn is likely coming. The expert expects the combination of persistent inflation, tighter financial conditions, and weaker global growth will push the U.S. economy into a mild recession in the first half of 2023. Overall, economists said that a recession can't be avoided, but that they expect it to be relatively shallow and short-lived. On average, they expect gross domestic product to expand at 0.1% annual rate in the first quarter of this year and to contract at 0.4% in the second. They see no growth for the third quarter and a 0.6% growth rate for the fourth, according to the report. Also, Arab News wrote in this regard, 2/3 of chief economists at the World Economic Forum have predicted a global recession in 2023 with continued geopolitical tensions and further monetary tightening in the US and Europe. The conclusion came in key findings of the chief Economist's Outlook, launched on Monday, January 16th, on the first day of the forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. Of the majority predicting a recession, 18% said it was extremely likely, against a third of respondents who thought the opposite. The outlook in September 2022 was slightly less gloomy, when 64% of respondents stated that a global recession was somewhat likely in 2023. Sadia Zahidi, managing director at the WEF, said, "With two-thirds of chief economists expecting a worldwide recession in 2023, the global economy is in a precarious position. The current high inflation, low growth, high debt, and high fragmentation environment reduces incentives for the investments needed to get back to growth and raise living standards for the world's most vulnerable," she added. "Leaders must look beyond today's crises to invest in food and energy innovation, education and skills development, and in job creating high potential markets of tomorrow. There is no time to lose." When surveyed about China, half of respondents said they expected a strong growth, while the remainder predicted the opposite. Recent efforts to loosen the country's zero-COVID policy were aimed at yielding a boost to growth, but it remained to be seen how disruptive the policy shift would be, namely in relation to health impacts. Inflation was expected to vary significantly across regions, with 5% of the chief economists predicting high inflation in China, while 57% believed the surge would happen in Europe. After a year of sharp and coordinated central bank tightening, the chief economist said the monetary policy stance would likely remain constant in most of the world this year. A majority, however, expected further monetary tightening in Europe and the US, 59% and 55% respectively. They highlighted that 2023 was likely to involve a difficult balancing act for policymakers between tightening too much or too little. Business activity was also forecast to receive numerous blows in 2023. 9 out of 10 respondents expected both weak demand and high borrowing costs to weigh on firms, with more than 60% also pointing to higher input costs. The chief economist expected the challenges to lead multinational businesses to cut costs, with 86% predicting that firms would reduce operational expenses, 78% expecting layoffs, and 77% seeing optimized supply chains this year. The chief economist expected the global landscape to remain challenging for businesses. 100% of respondents said global geopolitical trends would continue redrawing the map of world economic activity along new geopolitical fissures and fault lines.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Messenger of Allah. The most famous scholars of Imam al-Jawad's time asked His Eminence some of the most complicated philosophical, theological, and jurisprudential questions. And we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every single one of them. Among these great and famous scholars of the time was Yahya bin Aktham, the chief of the judges of Baghdad, whom the Abbasids had chosen to test Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Yahya bin Aktham asked Imam al-Jawad about a jurisprudential question, and Imam al-Jawad ramified the question into several branches, and then asked Yahya which branch he meant. The chief judge did not know what to say and could not save himself from that embarrassing situation and confessed that he could not keep up pace with Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, who was still in his tender youth.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are at your service talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the 9th divinely appointed Imam. So, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, was the divinely appointed Imam, meaning it was Allah the Almighty who selected him and chose him to be the leader of the Muslim Ummah, to be the leader of the Muslims and of humanity in general, thus becoming an Imam. Now, of course, in the Shia faith and the Shia madhab, we find that the Imam is the one who has the socio-political authority, he has the religious authority. He is, in reality, the focal point of the religion. He is the leader, the guide, and the one who takes every single one of us towards salvation and eternal prosperity. Of course, the Imam of our time is in occultation. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Now, one of the things, of course, we find that was something which was quite prevalent in the society in which Imam al-Jawad was living in, and it was his contemporary era, was the idea of oppression and injustice and tyranny. Now, of course, the Abbasid Caliphate and the Abbasid governmental establishment, we find, was very severe in suppressing and oppressing and subjugating their enemies and even their potential enemies, to the point where they would kill very openly many of these enemies. Now, it is quite unfortunate and interesting to note at the same time that the divinely appointed imams also posed a threat to the Abbasid governmental establishments, and thus we find that the Abbasids martyred the divinely appointed imams. And of course, if we just focus in on the era of the Abbasid Caliphate, we will find that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, Imam Rida alayhi salam, Imam Jawad alayhi salam, Imam Naqi alayhi salam, and Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, these are all imams that were martyred at the hands of the governmental establishment. It is quite a big thing. So this oppression and this injustice and this tyranny and this suppression of the Shias was something that was quite severe even in the age of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. So of course, you know, his companions would tell him about this oppression and suppression that was happening. And of course, they would complain, you know, and they would be sad at this, and they would be worried about this. And, you know, of course, it was something that was of concern for all of them. So in reply, we find that Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam, he says something very beautiful and very powerful to them. He says, "The day of justice on the oppressor is severer than the day of injustice on the oppressed." Allahu Akbar. So for example, all of these people were being oppressed, and these were the days of injustice that was happening to the oppressed, that was happening to the Shia, that was happening to the followers and the companions and the family members of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. So Imam says that this day of injustice that you are suffering at this current point is not as bad, it is not as severe, it is not as harsh as the day of justice that will happen to the oppressor. So here Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, warns us from practicing injustice and oppression against people, and any people, especially innocent people, because most surely Allah the Almighty will avenge the oppressed people sooner or later, whether it is in this world or the next. The unjust, the tyrants, the oppressors, the taghut, the arrogant powers, they will face the day of justice, and that day of justice that they will face will be much more severer and much more harsher than the day of injustice that we, the oppressed, are facing. So we must stay strong, and we must continue to pray for the hastening of the reappearance of the Imam of our time. May Allah hasten his reappearance. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaykum ayyuha an-nur as-safi. Assalamu alaykum ayyuha al-badr al-talim.
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Estimating the number of deaths attributable to COVID-19 around the world is a complex task, as highlighted by one attempt to measure global excess mortality in 2020 and 2021. In this regard, we have provided an article written by the scientific publication The Nature. Stay tuned for more. Knowing how COVID-19 affects global mortality rates is crucial if we are to understand the factors that govern its spread and severity and to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of governments' responses to the pandemic. In May, a team of researchers led by World Health Organization, WHO, and the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs published the first results from their attempt to estimate global COVID-19-related death rates. Writing in Nature, Ms. Berry et al. Present these estimates in more detail. Many deaths from COVID-19 went undetected in official reports from 2020 and 2021 because of limited testing capacity and misclassification of causes of death. This lack of data makes it challenging to qualify and quantify the mortality toll of short-term events, such as wars and natural disasters, as well as pandemics. For this reason, excess mortality, defined as the difference between all observed and expected deaths in a given period, is considered the gold standard approach for estimating the mortality toll of short-term events. But it is hard to find a universally effective way to measure excess mortality because there are substantial variations in underlying mortality trends and data availability across populations. Ms. Berry and colleagues set out to estimate excess deaths from COVID-19 for every country in the world. The authors report that there were between 13.2 million and 16.6 million more deaths than expected in 2020 and 2021. This death toll was between 2.4 and 3.4 times higher than the officially reported number of COVID-19-related deaths. 4 out of 5 excess deaths occurred in middle-income countries, with some of the worst affected in Latin America. In both years combined, the observed mortality in Peru was double the expected level, and it was between 41% and 51% higher than expected in Mexico, Bolivia, and Ecuador. Low-income countries had fewer deaths, mostly because they account for only 9% of the global population and have younger populations on average than do higher-income countries. Compared with the published data, Ms. Berry et al. Present more detailed methods and more refined estimates by adjusting the way in which underlying mortality trends were forecast for several countries. However, the author's estimates must be interpreted with extreme caution. This is because only 37% of countries had complete data for the number of people who died from any cause in each month of 2020 and 2021, an essential figure for accurately calculating excess mortality. There are no data at all for 43% of countries. 2% of countries had data for only some regions. 5% had only annual data, and 13% had incomplete monthly series. The availability of data is heavily correlated with income. For example, only 2% of European countries had no data for 2020, whereas for African countries, this figure was 87%. As a result, the authors had to take some problematic inferences. First, for countries that lack data in some regions, they had to scale death counts from subnational to national levels. This assumes a constant share of deaths between regions before and during the pandemic, but the spread, timing, and severity of COVID-19 within countries was far from uniform. Second, the researchers had to infer the number of expected and excess deaths in countries with no mortality data, mostly low-income countries, by extrapolating patterns from those with more complete data, mostly high-income countries that have robust healthcare systems. The researchers adjusted the patterns seen across the latter group to make estimates for the former using country-specific proxies for socioeconomic conditions. The intensity of the pandemic, each country's susceptibility to COVID-19, and its capacity to respond to the crisis. As such, half of global excess deaths were estimated without data on mortality or by using data from subnational regions. There are other factors to consider when interpreting Mesperi and colleagues' findings, including avoided and displaced mortality. The former refers to expected deaths that did not occur. For instance, influenza-related deaths that were avoided in 2020 and 2021 owing to changes in people's behavior and social isolation measures. The latter refers to deaths of frail or sick people that were expected to occur during the observation period, but were brought forward by COVID-19, producing a temporary surplus in mortality followed by a deficit, and consequently ignored when calculating cumulative excess deaths. Mesperi et al. Did not adjust for these factors because they aimed to identify all changes in mortality during the pandemic. Nevertheless, adjusting estimates for these numbers is essential if the goal is to understand COVID-19 fatality better. There are already models available that can adjust for influenza-related avoided mortality, and new approaches have been proposed for use in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. For displaced mortality, partial adjustments can be made by excluding mortality deficits when computing the cumulative number of excess deaths over the month of the observation period. The adjustment is only partial because COVID-19 deaths that occur during periods of overall deficit remain uncounted. Although the inferences made by Mesperi and colleagues are not ideal, there is no obvious alternative. However, speculative these estimates, most are surely closer to the truth than are officially reported numbers of deaths from COVID-19. To rely on confirmed deaths would imply that the pandemic spared low-income and lower-middle-income countries, vulnerable populations that have limited capacity for testing and response. This assumption is highly implausible and even irresponsible. Nonetheless, the complexity of the task is apparent from the fact that similar attempts to estimate the effects of the pandemic on global mortality have given different results. For the same period, the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle estimated 18.2 million excess deaths, and The Economist magazine estimated 16 million. Finally, the complexity of estimating the effect of the pandemic on global mortality underscores the urgent need to build robust, centralized systems that allow for real-time monitoring of global mortality. The construction of such systems will require considerable global efforts to strengthen civil registration and crucial statistics systems worldwide, especially in low- and middle-income countries. But once built, they will serve as an essential early warning for future pandemics and health crises.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies.
31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program,
Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been transmitted and passed down to us from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. This hadith is about the attributes of an intelligent person. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "The attribute of a man of intellect is that he is clement towards one who behaves rationally. The attribute of a man of intellect is that he is clement, he is patient towards one who behaves rashly with him. He overlooks the fault of one who wrongs him, is humble even towards the one who is lower than him in rank, tries to get ahead of those above him in his quest for good. Whenever he wishes to speak, he contemplates. If what he wants to say is good, he says it and benefits as a result. And if it is bad, then he keeps quiet and remains safe as a result. When a temptation arises before him, he holds fast to Allah and guards his hand and his tongue. If he sees virtue in it, he seizes it, neither losing his modesty thereat, nor displaying any greed. These are 10 qualities by means of which a man of intellect may be known." Right? These are 10 qualities the Prophet Muhammad mentioned for a man of intellect. Let's go over these qualities once again. First of all, the person is patient towards people who are, you know, who are bad towards him, who act rashly and harshly towards him, first of all, one. Second of all, he overlooks the faults of people who wrong him. If people, you know, wrong him, he forgets about it, forgives them. Third, he's humbled towards even those who are lower than him. Fourth, he tries to get ahead of those above him in his quest for good. Meaning, if there's somebody who is above him, who's superior to him, he tries to oversurpass him with the hope of getting an authority so that he can use that authority and power to do good. Fifth, when he wants to speak, he contemplates. If he thinks that what he's going to say is good, he will say it. Otherwise, he keeps quiet. Sixth, when a temptation arises before him, he holds fast to Allah. He guards his hand and his tongue. If he sees virtue in it, he seizes it. Otherwise, he doesn't do it. Right? In a similar hadith, which is more comprehensive, kind of alludes to a lot of these qualities at once, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "The most intelligent of people is he who is best at dealing with people." Right? This kind of combines within itself all of those qualities mentioned. Right? In another hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam was once asked to describe a man of intellect, to which he replied in the following way: "He is the one who puts things in their place." Then he was asked, "So describe to us the ignorant man," to which he replied, "I have already done so." He's the person, meaning, in other words, he's the person who doesn't put things in their proper place. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the characteristics and attributes of the intelligent person in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Aqa for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.